This is an ABC podcast.
Hey, so it's Monday, back to work for a lot of you, and probably pretty hard to drag yourself out of the house. So what if you just didn't have to anymore? It's Dave Marchese with you for Hack, and in a sec we're getting into flexible work. It's a topic that's really been blowing up lately in the headlines. Also coming up, we've got an update on one of the biggest court cases of the year in Australia, as well as a chat with one of our most controversial writers.
Hack. Anyone who wishes to do remote work must be in the office for a minimum, and I mean minimum, of 40 hours per week or depart Tesla.
On Triple J.
Yeah, there was a time when telling your boss that you had no interest in returning to the office probably would have meant that you'd have to find a new job. But times have changed. Working from home is pretty normal these days, even out of lockdowns. And employers are actually struggling to get workers back into the office. They're using all sorts of stuff. Coffee carts, free yoga classes to try to make the workplace more attractive. But will it work? I want to hear from you. Are you holding off going back to the office? Or maybe you couldn't wait to get back. Or the other thing is, maybe you're a worker that doesn't have a choice, a nurse, a paramedic. What do you think of this whole flexible work conditions debate? Let me know. You can call in 1300 055 536, or you can message in as well 0439 757 555. Ellie Grounds has more.
You are in bed.
I am not in bed.
That's
I am
bed.
In my office.
That's a bed.
This is the office. The time here is 3 o'clock.
Yeah, we're now, let me check, 2.5 years into this pandemic, and we're still arguing about whether or not we can trust employees to work from home.
I do not believe that it increases productivity. I think it's nonsense. I think in many cases it's an excuse to drink beer in the garden when the sun is shining.
The debate heated up again last week after Tesla CEO Elon Musk,
he did become the richest person in the world while his employees were working from home,
sent a staff email with the subject, remote work is no longer acceptable.
Anyone who wishes to do remote work must be in the office for a minimum, and I mean minimum, of 40 hours per week or depart Tesla. This is less than we ask of factory workers.
When he was asked about the direction on Twitter, Musk said employees that wouldn't comply could pretend to work somewhere else. Ooh, judgy, judgy.
Okay, first of all, Elon, isn't 40 hours a week like the whole work week?
Work like hell. I mean, you just have to put in, you know, 80 to 100 hour weeks every week.
And that's then a lot of work.
All those things improve the odds of success.
Right, well, guess not. Anyway, putting that to one side, his demand that people ditch working from home has gotten some people really fired up.
You know, he's a self-important bore, okay?
Yeah.
Elon Musk, by the way, when he went to space, should have kept going into the sun. Like, he's just an odious human being.
Can I just say?
And a jerk.
I would never publicly say that I wouldn't work for a specific company, but if you ever see me working for Tesla, just know I've been kidnapped.
One of the co-founders of Australian software company Atlassian, Scott Farquhar, tweeted a thread saying that it felt like something out of the 1950s. And he finished with a link to Atlassian's careers page, asking, any Tesla employees interested?
Burn, David.
But other people are totally backing Elon Musk.
If it's his company, this is the way he wants to run it, that's perfectly fine. And people can decide if they want to work for a company now they've gotten used to other things.
So Elon Musk doing his bit to make people get back to the office, to work, to communicate. And you know what? To act as teams working together. And I have to say, you know, just full marks to him.
And while working from home does have its benefits, you know, no commuting time, better flexibility with your non-work life, the ability to do your job while wearing pajama pants, some people are worried less time in the office is going to lead to shitty outcomes for one group in particular, women.
Given we know that domestic and caring labour is not equitably distributed, that there's a risk that if nothing else changes in 5 years' time, what we'll see is a pattern where women have chosen, particularly women in the family formation stage, have chosen disproportionately to work at home. Men have been much more regular attenders at the office.
This is former Prime Minister Julia Gillard speaking at a women's leadership panel last week.
That very visibility, if nothing else changes, will show in who is being considered for promotion, who's being considered for sponsorship, mentorship, who's being put on the best of the training opportunities, because the women will be kind of invisible behind the screen.
Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds there, and I want to know what you think. Are you all for working from home, or do you hate it? Let me know, 1300 055 536. 0439 757 555. You can message in as well. We're already hearing from you on the text line. Someone says, I love working from home. I'm much happier and much more productive. I've got Briggsy on the line from the Sunshine Coast. Briggsy, what's your experience?
Yeah, look, I used to work in the office all the time, but what I found, we worked from home. I was much more productive than I was at home. Because I'd go into the office, you get distracted, there's people making noise, and some people rather talk about maths and all that other stuff that's on TV than worry about getting the work done. So it was far more productive working from home.
Yeah, interesting. We've got a few people, Briggsy, backing you up here saying, yeah, nah, I feel like it's a lot better and I've come up with a bit of a situation where I am working more efficiently. I don't have to worry about other people distracting me. Somebody says, I'm never going back to the office. If my current employer ever forces me to do so, I'll change jobs. Bad employers will lose all their staff to the good employers who let their staff work from home. Well, let's keep this chat going. And with me now is Dr. Sean Gallagher. He's with the Centre for the New Workforce at Swinburne University of Technology. Dr. Gallagher, thanks for coming on Hack.
Afternoon, Dave. Thanks for having me.
What did you think when you heard about Elon Musk ordering his workers back into the office?
Well, first, can I say, how cool would it be to work for Elon? I think I'd probably choose SpaceX over Tesla, but, you know, a pretty cool gig. You know, Elon can probably get away with what he wants. You know, there's probably 100 workers that would take any worker's position that didn't want to follow that mandate. But let's take a look at the two reasons that Elon wants everyone back in the office. The first, he says that in-person collaboration can only happen in the office. And the second, he wants to avoid what I call a flexibility divide. So, you know, flexibility available to those office workers, but not those on the factory floor. And based on our research, he's only half right on both of those measures. So if I can maybe break it down. So first of all, for in-person collaboration, you know, creating new things is absolutely should be done in person. In fact, a Nature paper got released a few weeks ago, a four-year study that shows that creativity suffers when trying to do it virtually. But you know what? We're not creating all the time. Every job has routine elements. And our research shows that's the stuff that is actually better done remotely. And secondly, in terms of he wants to avoid the flexibility divide, you know, factory workers who have to turn up on site for their shift every time versus those in head office that can wear, you know, hoodies and Uggs and everything else at home. I think reverting back to pre-COVID is not our reality. You know, the rocket ship is already in orbit, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
Our research shows that both office and on-site workers want flexibility equally. And it's partly because of, you know, huge well-being matters. So in fact, so to avoid the flexibility divide, I think we need to do a 180 to Elon Musk and figure out how to give flexibility to all workers.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the flex divide. In your research, you talk about this. What is that?
So the flexibility divide is where, you know, we've had, let's look at the last 2.5 years. So before, you know, 2020, March 2020, none of us were talking hybrid. It's a whole thing that's come about. But through forced lockdowns, we found that those who are knowledge workers, so we found that they could work virtually. And all of a sudden, we realized that their work was no longer location dependent. And as you know, many of them moved regional headquarters or away from, you know, where they were living before. And so their job, they've got a lot of flexibility in both where and when. However, that's only 40% of the workforce. The other 60% have been keeping the country going. They've turned up in our hospitals and our supermarkets and on our buses. And, you know, they have had to go to a workplace, a work site in order to do their jobs. And so we've had 2 years to figure out flexible working for those knowledge workers. And all of a sudden, you know, and, you know, because of the war for talent, organizations are having to offer flexibility for those. But organizations that have both types of workers are creating that divide because all of a sudden those in the factory or those on site or those in the call center are seeing that their head office colleagues have this fantastic privilege, yet they don't get it. They want it as much as those in head office. We just have to figure out why. And clearly flexibility will have a different definition for them.
We've got a few messages coming through. Renee from Hornsby says, I work in recruitment and whilst I think balance is good, I think it's the junior staff who will suffer. Yeah, that's an interesting point about, you know, training and how that's all affected if people are working from home. Somebody else says, I'd procrastinate all day if I had to work from home. And Kay from Melbourne says, I get more distracted in the office. So having a hybrid blend is good. However, I'm an extrovert, so working solo at home is actually not great for my mental health, which is another point that we should talk about as well. First, I want to go to Ben. Ben, what's your experience? Do you work from home? And if so, do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I've just started a new job where I was able to negotiate to work from home, 3 days a week. And it's fantastic.
Yeah. And would you ever think about, you know, going back full time to the office?
Not really. So contrary to the last person's message, I'm kind of an introvert myself, and I'm way more productive. I'm able to work from home and 3 days a week, and as a result, I save myself, 2 hours commuting a day, really. So I think I'm way more productive.
Interesting. Ben, thank you very much for your call. I just wanted to ask you, Sean, about workplace laws. I guess we've got to keep those up to date with flexible work arrangements as well.
Yeah, it's a typical case of where, you look at Uber, for example. Uber came out, it was a fantastic innovation, and our laws and regulations weren't anywhere near able to figure out what is this new form of service. And in some ways, that's the same thing that's happened with flexible work. The innovation has really taken off, and under our Fair Work system, it didn't ever really consider, all of the different options around flexible working. Let me just give you one example, for instance. So you can imagine that those people who don't have to turn up to a work site, they may choose to take a couple of hours off in the day to do whatever, Pilates class or go to the gym or caring responsibilities, and to make up that work by either, getting up early in the morning or working later at night. But under our Fair Work system, it doesn't distinguish whether you're actually working. If you're working out of those hours, it's considered overtime, be it because of workload. So if you work the whole day and you have to work after work just to get it done, or whether you've taken time off in the day and you're choosing to work at the end of the day. So under our Fair Work system, there's no distinguishing between, overtime, legitimate overtime, and working by choice. And so those workers who choose to work after hours are actually due overtime payment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Dr. Sean Gallagher from Swinburne, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
And we've got some messages coming through. Lauren from Borkham Hill says, I'm an employer. It should be up to the employer to decide, really, based on their work and their assessment of productivity according to them.
Hack, my frustration is that people talk about Islam without knowing anything about it. On Triple J.
5 years ago, it would have been hard to find a young person more talked about in Australia than writer Yasmin Abdel-Majid. Maybe you remember her going head-to-head with Senator Jackie Lambie on Q&A over Sharia law, or the 7-word Facebook post she put up on Anzac Day in 2017 that said, lest we forget Manus Nauru, Syria, Palestine. She pretty quickly deleted and apologised for that post, but the condemnation was intense, and she went from being a golden child to, as she put it, the most publicly hated Muslim in Australia. Well, Yasmin left Australia after that. She's been in the UK ever since, and now she's written a book that covers that part of her life. It's called Talking About a Revolution, and she's here with me to talk about it. Yasmin, welcome to Hack.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a road, right? It's been 5 years since your Anzac Day post, and people will remember the backlash was huge. It was toxic. You left Australia for London, where you live now. 5 years is a long time to reflect on things. Do you look back at that whole period and go, what was that?
Yeah, it is actually wild to me that it's been like literally half a decade. It was so surreal and like weirdly traumatic that my brain kind of doesn't remember big chunks of it. So from about like late 2016 to honestly 2020, my brain was like, nah. And then obviously we had the pandemic for a couple of years. So really, my brain is back in 2015. That's what I'm going with.
Yeah, wow. I mean, well, back in 2017, you wrote about your feelings, and this is all in the book. You wrote, you were the most publicly hated Muslim in Australia. You said, I get death threats on a daily basis. I've resorted to moving house, changing my phone number, deleting my social media apps. You talked about horrible things that people sent you, and you said, I wonder if the only thing that will stop them is my death. After that horrific experience, what made you decide, actually, I'm going to put together this book and re-explore that part of my life and talk about it publicly again? Why did you want to do this now?
Some sort of masochistic, you know? I had to write about it to be able to process it. And honestly, this for me is like, you know, it is my response to that time in my own words and on my own terms, because constantly, like over the last 5 years, people have very regularly reached out. They want to do documentaries. They want to do interviews. They want to do this. They want to do that. And I'm like, I've always been like, I have to do this on my own terms and in my own words. So in a way, this is, you know, this collection is that. I'm talking about a revolution and I'm doing it in my own way.
So you're out there and you're speaking about the book. The headlines are popping up again in recent days.
Boom, boom.
Yeah. What does that feel like? Does that bring back a lot of emotions when you see, you know, yourself being written about in Australia again? How do you feel?
There's a couple of different things that come up when I see my name pop up in ways that are, I would say, perhaps more clickbaity than about the book that I'm trying to talk about. One, I think, gosh, how is it that 5 years on, I'm still able to, like, you know, for the lack of a better phrase, trigger people so heavily, right? Like I say a couple of things and people are like, oh my God, she said what? And I'm like, wow, I really still have the power to elicit such a strong response. How fascinating. The second thing I think is like, it also makes me wonder how much has changed, because quite often people say, oh, you know, like Australia's changed a lot. You should really come back. Like things are different here. And I'm like, well, my engagement with the media doesn't really illustrate that much has changed. I walked into this fairly openly and I talked to my, you know, all of my team and my friends and family. And I was like, look, I'm going to go back out there, but let's just with an open mind, but let's see how it goes. And the evidence is there for all to see. Obviously, I am also talking about things that people find challenging. I'm talking about my relationship with the concept of citizenship. I'm talking about things like neoliberalism and how we, you know, how that's kind of like embedded into all of our psyches. I'm talking about my relationship with my religion and my faith. And I am talking about really challenging issues. But at the same time, I think I am much more equipped because I'm doing it in a way that I want to. You know, the power is in my hands. And yes, people can respond in any way and they can write whatever headlines they want to write. But at the end of the day, I have a lot more power in a way that I think I didn't back when I was 25, 26 years old. And I'm much more sure of myself and the kind of world that I care about and whose opinions I pay attention to.
Yeah, I can imagine when you left Australia 5 years ago, it was really raw. You would have been feeling a lot of things, but it sounds like there is still stuff that's triggering. And I've seen, like in a recent interview, you said, if you're out in London and you hear an Australian accent somewhere, you'll leave. In the book, like you mentioned, you ponder what it would mean to give up your Australian passport. And you say, if I give up my citizenship, will I finally truly become un-Australian? I'm wondering, where does Australia sit in your life now?
It's a tough question, Dave. I don't know. I think the jury's out. Yeah, I think for me right now, it is a place that I spent 24 years of my life. It is a place that was very formative, but it was also a place that was the site of the most painful experiences in a really public way. And I can't really divorce my relationship with the country from those experiences. And I think that ultimately, I was used as a cautionary tale for people in the country about what happens if you are an individual who's outside the dominant culture, who speaks your mind and who does so unapologetically. That's something the country has to grapple with, right? Because you know what? People reference this as a social media cancellation. People are often like, oh, you know, you got canceled on social media. I'm like, no. I was targeted by legacy and traditional media first, and then that was turned into something that social media then piled onto. Now, what does that say about the country? My relationship with the country is actually less about me and more about the kind of country that Australia is and wants to be. And that's what I write about in talking about a revolution. I'm like, how my experiences and the reason why I challenge people, okay, what does it mean for me to give up potentially, to question the idea of my Australian citizenship? The reason I ask that is because what is my citizenship predicated on? It's predicated on, you know, the fact that First Nations people don't have sovereignty. Is that actually what I want my citizenship to be predicated on? Why is it that the country that I was born in, Sudan, doesn't have, you know, it's not a country whose citizenship matters in the great white world, the great wide world, not the great white world, but also, you know, both were. And so I think I'm trying to, like, my relationship with Australia is really up for grabs. The jury is very much still out. It's something that ebbs and flows. It really is the scene of the crime for me.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, and I'm joined by writer Yasmin Abdelmajid, whose new book, Talking About a Revolution, is out now. I've seen and heard a lot of interviews with you over the years, and people often ask you something like, do you regret doing or saying any of those things, or would you do anything differently? I don't want to ask you that. What I am interested in, though, are your thoughts on this. If all of that stuff, the posts, the controversial moments, whatever, everything from 2017 and earlier happened in Australia today, how different do you think the response would be? Or would it be different?
Honestly, Dave, I have no idea. What do you think? Like, I genuinely, because I've not been in the country for the last 5 years. Do you think it would be different?
I think it would be.
That has to be the hope, right? Like, I hope my experience gets used as a cautionary tale, but not in the way that it was intended by those who attacked me, but as a way to remind folks who are working for a more just society that, like, we can't let that happen to anyone again. We can't let that happen to anyone again. Like, that's just got to be the way that people approach things. You can't let a young woman be isolated by herself to cop it for months on end, to be driven out of the place that she loved and called home. You just can't let that happen, because that can't be the country that everyone is happy to be a part of, right? And that is everybody's responsibility. That is everybody's responsibility, especially for people in positions of power. And you know what? I have made my peace with that. I am not a bitter person. You know, obviously I have been, you know, through it, but what I cannot abide is if it is let to happen again, because then what was my experience for?
I wonder, Yasmin, with your experience, everything you've learned over the years, what would be your advice for young Australians out there who may be struggling with their place in society?
Oh, gosh. Listen, being young is not easy, you know. I am glad that that is something I've grown out of. But what I will say is this, the stakes when you're young are really high. Every single thing seems like the stakes are really, really high. But one of the things that has always gotten me through the toughest times is this really simple, maybe obvious idea that, like, time will pass. And whatever it is you're going through, I went through an experience I wouldn't even wish on my worst enemy. And someone said to me, you know, the one good thing about this world is that time will pass. You can start again. I'm in my, like, fourth career and I just turned 31. You know, like, we think that the choices you make at the age of 17, 18, 21, we think they will define us for the rest of our lives. They will not. The mistakes we make, we think they'll define us for the rest of our lives. They do not have to. You have no idea what life will look like on the other end, but inshallah, it will be better.
Yasmin Abdelmajid, thanks very much for coming on Hack.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
And Yasmin's book, Talking About a Revolution, is out now.
Hack.
This was billed as the sort of trial of the century, but it's gotten bigger than anyone expected it to be. We've been going for months now and we're nowhere near finished.
On Triple J.
Well, after 99 days in court and more than $25 million in legal fees, the final witness has given evidence in the Ben Robert Smith defamation case. Australia's most famous soldier is suing the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The Canberra Times. He says he was defamed by stories that portrayed him as committing war crimes, including murder. It's been an intense court battle. Soldiers have given evidence both supporting and condemning Ben Robert Smith. So what's going to happen now? Perry Duffin is the chief court reporter at the Daily Telegraph. He's covered this whole case and he's with me now. G'day, Perry. Perry.
G'day, Dave. How are you?
Thanks for remembering my name. Thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
In the beginning, this trial was only set down for a few weeks, right? But it's dragged on. Why has it taken so long?
Well, it's really, really complex. It was always going to be a big one, but we had COVID in the middle of this. So it was sort of like 6 months of solid case, but with a big 6 month gap in between, because so many of the soldiers are from WA. And so, you know, with the hard border, they literally couldn't get over here to talk or to give evidence because it was top secret. So they couldn't do it over the phone. They had to do it in person. So that was one reason why it's taken so long.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard about, you know, what Ben Robert Smith is suing over, but can you talk us through some of the bigger evidence that was heard in this trial? What was some of the big stuff?
It all looks so. Two main real allegations at the end of all this are really above and beyond everything else, where basically the allegations are that Ben Robert Smith either executed unarmed, imprisoned Afghans while with the SAS, or he ordered other soldiers to do it. He denies that totally, but we've heard multiple soldiers come in and say they were, you know, effectively part of the cover-up or part of the mission, and they saw, you know, parts of it happen. Others have refused to testify. They've said, I would be incriminating for, you know, really serious things. I think one bloke even said the crime of murder. And so we've heard really, really serious allegations about what the SAS were doing in Afghanistan. And then, of course, plenty of soldiers, including Ben Robert Smith, saying, no, this never happened. And these accusers are basically really bitter that, you know, Ben Robert Smith was given this really big award, which was the Victoria Cross for bravery back in 2010.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I mean, like people talking, some of the witnesses giving evidence, talking about the same days, the same times and experiences, but very different recollections. Another thing's the cost of this. Like, as I said, it's reported that $25 million has been spent in legal fees. Who's paying for this? It's not Ben Robert Smith, is it?
No, it's definitely not Ben Robert Smith. It's on one side, the people he's suing are Nine. So media company, they're the ones who publish the newspapers. And so they're the defendants. And then Ben Robert Smith is actually being funded his legal battle by his boss, which is the head of Seven Network, Kerry Stokes. Kerry Stokes is a billionaire. He runs Seven and he's a big advocate for veterans, and he sort of goes around and does a lot of work with veterans. And so he's picking up Ben Robert Smith's legal bills, along with a few other soldiers who are testifying for him as well.
Right. It's so expensive. It's so much money. It's sometimes easy to forget as well, Perry, that Ben Robert Smith was actually the one who brought this case, you know, and regardless of the outcome, it's going to have huge implications, I would think, on his reputation, right?
Oh, absolutely. He was a very public figure before these articles came out. He was a public speaker. He was an executive at Seven. And, you know, he was a father of the year, a very public man and a very celebrated guy. And now after these articles came out, he said that it's really ruined his life. It's ruined his public life, certainly. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, on Twitter and stuff, they say, oh, what, you know, he brought this on himself with this lawsuit and unearthed all these allegations. Well, the majority of them, certainly the murder accusations, were published by Nine initially. So it was already out there in public, but this trial really has been really, really high profile and really has brought a lot of focus on him that I'm sure he isn't too happy about.
And Perry, we've only got 30 seconds left, but now that the evidence has wrapped up, what happens next?
Well, what's next is we've got closing submissions in July. That's when both sides will summarise their evidence and how they think it helps them. And then it could be up to a year before we get a verdict back.
Wow.
And meanwhile, there are still investigations from war crime investigators going on. No one is charged, but that's still happening in the background.
Right, so there are some investigations that are happening in the background. That's really interesting. Court reporter Perry Duffin, thank you so much for coming on Hack and for filling us in.
Thanks, Dave.
And that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.
Hack on Triple J.
This is an ABC podcast.